In mid-September of 1692, about 7 months after the witch hysteria had broken out, an old man was forced to lay on the ground in an open field near the jail in Salem. A pallet of wood was likely placed on top of him, and soon after, heavy stones were carefully rolled on top of the pallet, harshly pressing their weight down upon his more than 70-year-old body. The unfortunate old man in that field was Giles Corey, and 5 months earlier, in April, he had been accused of witchcraft and arrested, at a time when many of his neighbors were suffering the same fate. But by mid-September, attitudes seemed to have hardened. 11 people had already been executed for witchcraft, and more would be hanged at Proctor's Ledge soon. Giles Corey, however, had refused to issue a plea to the court. It was a perfunctory exercise that under normal circumstances the authorities would likely have paid little attention to. But after months of escalating crisis, these were not normal times, and the powers that be in Salem were not taking any chances. The archaic and barbarous torture method that Giles Corey was subjected to on that September day was meant to force him to submit to the authority of the court, but instead, it sank Salem deeper into the abyss. To help us understand this unique and particularly dark moment of the witch crisis, we are joined by Rachel Chris Doan, who is the Director of Education at the Salem Witch Museum in Salem, Massachusetts. Why don't we start out by having you address a little bit of Giles Corey's background?
So Giles Corey, like many people from this time, has kind of a sketchy background. It's hard to come up with exact details. The guess that our museum goes with is he's born circa 1619 in Northampton, England. But again, that's an approximation. It can be very hard to pin down the exact birth dates for many of the people involved. We don't know a lot about his background. We don't know the names of his parents. We don't know, you know, does he have siblings, things like that. We know he's first recorded in Essex County in Salem in 1644. So that's where our records pick up and we can start to have some definitive information about him.
So Giles Corey had a run-in with the law a few years prior to the witch hysteria. Can you talk a little bit about that?
He has a run-in with the law actually quite a few times. He is a very kind of colorful person is maybe the right word. You know, he appears in records actually a fair amount because he's getting in trouble. So he has a couple of instances where he's accused of stealing at one point. He is accused of falling asleep on watch, which, you know, you're not supposed to do, particularly in this time when indigenous attack is a very real threat. And then the most kind of significant instance is he is accused of killing someone. So this is a man who's described in the records as simple-minded. So, you know, we don't know exactly what that means about his mental state. He is certainly somebody who is struggling or who's maybe developmentally delayed, something of that nature. That's usually what that verbiage indicates. He stole from Giles Corey and Giles responded by beating him, which we should note was allowed. You were allowed to beat your servants, beat your wives, you know, things like that. It's a very violent time in that way to a degree, but it was beating within reason. And this really escalated beyond what was normal. So that man does end up dying. His name is Jacob Goodale and Giles is accused of killing him. And he kind of slips through it. He has to pay a fine, but he is not convicted of murder. It seems to do with the mental state of that man. The court seems to have been lenient with him. So it's kind of a fuzzy picture. It does not paint a good image of a person like Giles Corey. And that is an incident that does get brought up to a degree during the Salem witch trials.
That March of 1692, once the hysteria kind of gins up, it appears that Giles Corey is pretty into it, right? Like he's going to the examinations. He seems to be caught up in it. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Giles is definitely, you know, he can't look away, much like everyone else. You know, that was the reaction from most of the community. It was horrifying to believe that witches were present in Salem. And I'm sure you talk about this at length on this podcast, but that was a very real threat for people during this time. Unquestionably, witches existed for these individuals. They heard about it regularly during church services. Their ministers would remind them about the threats from the devil and from his followers. And we should remember that misfortune could be interpreted as the work of witches. And there's certainly a lot of misfortune happening in Massachusetts Bay Colony and also in Salem Village in the years leading up to 1692. So when the initial girls, Betty and Abigail, when it is said that their illness is being caused by witchcraft, that was very believable for people at the time. It made a lot of sense and it was very frightening. So it makes sense that there's kind of surge of public interest, especially once people are accused and they are brought in for questioning. Those first three people, Sarah Good, Sarah Osborne, and Tituba, it makes a lot of sense for people of the time. Those three are all social outsiders for one reason or another. It's very easy for people of the time to believe that they had sold their souls to the devil. I always say when I'm talking to student groups or visitors or what have you, if you're looking for a scapegoat, somebody to blame during a time of escalated fear, you're going to look for someone who makes you feel uncomfortable to begin with. And that's what we see happening. So those early proceedings would have been very interesting, very alarming for people. They would have wanted to hear what was going on. So Giles very much fits into that category. We know that he really wanted to go into Salem Village. He is living in what is today Peabody, at the time Salem Farms. He would have wanted to travel in to listen to the proceedings. We know his wife Martha did not want him to go. There's an incident that's recorded where he's saddling up his horse to go into the village and she pulls the saddle off the horse. So she's very skeptical right off the bat. But he, like so many others, is very interested in attending, and he does.
So he's very much into it. But then around mid-March, his wife gets accused. Can you talk a little bit about how that shifted things?
Yeah, the accusation of Martha Corey is very interesting because, as we've just said, the first three people who are accused kind of make sense. They're all kind of classic examples of people who could be scapegoated in this particular situation. Martha is interesting, though, because she is a fully communing member of the Salem Village Church. So that's very strange. You know, Puritan 101, if you are accepted as a member of the church, that means that you had theoretically examined your soul and had come to the conclusion that you were one of the few chosen saints who are destined for heaven in this context of predestination. So Martha is a member of the church, which theoretically means she is going to heaven. She is a saint. But she's got scandal in her past as well. Some records suggest she may have given birth to a child outside of her previous marriage, her first marriage. The child is described as mulatto in certain records, so he may have been of a mixed race. It's all very hazy, but there does seem to be this kind of scandal in her past. But by 1692, she's this self-described gospel woman, a member of the church, you know. So she is a less clear candidate to be accused of witchcraft. So it's interesting that she's named. You know, she certainly fits the profile to a degree of making people uncomfortable, but also a member of the church. All very strange. You know, we can trace these moments where the panic ramps up a notch throughout 1692. That's an interesting moment, the accusation of Martha Corey, which comes at the beginning. Now, I do want to say that a misconception about Martha's accusation that you often hear is that Giles threw under the bus and testified against her and said, yes, my wife's a witch. That's not what happened. He does have these kind of grumblings in the early days of the panic that his wife is a little witchy, we could say. He says things like, there's been some strange things happening around his home. She entered a room once and it stopped him from praying. Just kind of supernatural-esque things. But we kind of read these as like the grumbling of an older man, you know? He's not saying them in the context of she has been charged with witchcraft and he's telling it to a magistrate. He's just kind of grumbling at his neighbors about this. One of my colleagues calls Giles and Martha the Bickersons. They kind of paint this picture of an older married couple who snip back and forth at each other. But once Martha has been accused of witchcraft, Giles does come to her defense. There's talk of an ointment in their house that might be, you know, something associated with witchcraft. And Giles tells the magistrates, no, that's actually a recipe that was given to her by Bartholomew Gedney's wife. And Gedney will later be a magistrate on the trials. So he does come to her defense and say she's not a witch on record once she's been accused. And when she's arrested and brought to Boston, he travels with her all the way to the ferry. And he doesn't go as far as Boston because he doesn't have the money to transport himself there. So he does paint the picture of someone who's supporting his wife once push comes to shove. But not long after this, he himself is accused of witchcraft. Like so many people, it's very hard to say why is he accused. Unfortunately, we're just left with some sketchy records, you know, some records that are written by very biased sources that are giving us very brief summaries. So we can make some educated guesses, but it's hard to say. In Giles' case, it's probably his connection to Martha. We do see families being accused. Oftentimes it's the women in a family. You don't necessarily see husband and wives being accused that often. But Giles also seems to have really pushed back against Martha's accusation. And in the cases of quite a few of the men who are accused, and especially those who are convicted, we see them speaking out against the trials, just refusing to accept that what was happening was legal, was right. So we could imagine that it could also be his vocal skepticism. It's hard to say how vocal it was, though. This is just reading between the lines, but it seems like maybe he attracts their attention by saying, now, wait a second, Martha's not a witch, you know, and really kind of going from there and making his opinions known.
Probably the most famous component of Giles Corey's historical record is the fact that he did not, as one was supposed to do, utter a plea, and as a result was subject to torture in order to enter a plea. Can you talk a little bit about why that was important according to English law?
So the way that criminal trial was supposed to proceed by English common law was a person would be brought forward and they would have to answer a traditional question posed at the beginning of a trial. They would ask you, how will you be tried? And you were supposed to say, by God and my country. And that was essentially you acknowledging the authority of the court to try you. Now, what's interesting about this is we do have on record cases of people refusing to answer the question, not that many years before the trials. I would have to look at what the actual year was, but it's a piracy case from only, you know, maybe a handful of years before 1692, where several of the magistrates who preside in 1692 are involved. And they have a person who stood accused, asked the question, won't comply, and they just moved on with the trial and he was ultimately convicted. So there is precedent for not following that procedure to the letter. So what's going on with Giles Corey's case? I do also want to just stress that this has nothing to do with him hanging on to his land. That is a common misconception that you hear in scholarship surrounding the Salem witch trials until relatively recently. In fact, our museum has that inaccuracy in our presentation. It's one of the things that we have been working to remove as elements of dated scholarship. But there's this kind of myth that Giles refused to enter a plea because he thought if he was convicted, they were going to take away his land. And that has to do with this bigger misconception of the Salem witch trials are a land grab. Neighbors are accusing neighbors because they wanted their land or they wanted their belongings. And that is not how English common law worked at the time. This is one of those things where somebody says it, it gets repeated and repeated in the scholarship, and then it takes a while for us to really go back and look and say, wait, just a second, that's not what's going on here. A person who is accused of a crime in colonial New England, the accuser certainly gained nothing from the accusation, and the crown couldn't take your land. They could take movable goods from your home to cover your court fees, so livestock and things like that. And there's some really sad cases from the trials where that does happen, but it's not land and it's not for personal gain in terms of your neighbors. Nobody had been pressed in colonial New England up until this point. That was never resorted to. And there are very few cases in English history, by my understanding. This does not happen often, especially in the late 17th century. So Giles is pressing. Again, it kind of flags for us another moment of escalation in the panic. So as I said before, we see these events where the panic is ratcheting up another notch and then another notch and then another notch. So Giles being brought before the court, he says, I am innocent, but I will not essentially acknowledge the authority of the court is an indication of where we are by September. He is saying that I know I'm not going to get a fair trial and I'm not going to acknowledge this court. That's an act of considerable bravery at that point, because he likely knew that in a best case scenario, he would be hanged. In a worst case scenario, something like this would happen. And he is given 3 days to enter a plea. We know that his friends came to him and really tried to reason with him and say, just tell them what they want to hear, you know, just comply with the court. He refused to do it. And as a result, they resort to pressing him. Even in this moment of considerable panic, watching a elderly man, you know, we think he's probably around 73 years old, be crushed to death publicly, that was something that was shocking, even for Puritans. You know, that was horrifying. It didn't happen regularly. And that's another moment we can flag again, as people are just starting to really think something is not right here. Things are spiraling out of control.
I think it's important to actually talk a little bit about the mechanics of this torture, just so people can have a visual, because it's sometimes hard to even imagine what that would look like, right? So can you talk a little bit about what the pressing actually consisted of?
By our primary source records, which, you know, again, they're giving us kind of a sketchy picture of what happened, but it seems that Giles is taken to an open field. Historian Marilyn Roach has argued this was probably the field just directly across the street from the jail, which was owned by the Putnam family. And the Putnams had been kind of avidly going after Giles by this point. So it seems like they would have volunteered the field, and why go far from the site where he's being imprisoned? So she's made that argument, and I believe her. I think she's probably right. So they seem to have taken him across the street. They lie him flat on his back. They place a board over his chest, and heavy stones are placed gradually on the board, slowly crushing him to death. We do know Robert Califf, in his skeptical account of the trials, More Wonders of the Invisible World, says that his tongue starts to bulge out of his mouth during this torture, and the sheriff uses his cane to kind of poke it back in. I will take this opportunity, though, to say him saying the phrase, more weight, we don't know if that happened. It probably didn't, to be honest. It's a great story, right? It adds color to the tale. And for those of you who don't know, as the legend goes, as the torture's happening, he's asked if he will comply with the court, if he will answer. And his only response was more weight. That's actually a phrase that comes from a poem that would have been well known at the time. And it's about someone being pressed to death and them saying more weight. So that seems to have just kind of been glommed onto this story. But either way, that's kind of the folk tradition that comes down to us over time. Realistically, he probably wouldn't have been able to formulate words. And there's another kind of myth that it took him 3 days to die. That is not supported by the primary sources. He was given 3 days to comply with the court. So he sits in jail for 3 days and is given a chance to say, you know what, I will acknowledge the authority before they press him. That seems to be where that confusion has come from. Realistically, he probably dies in a couple hours at most. Giles is pressing. I won't say it's the turning point. We can't say anything is the turning point. It certainly builds the public outrage, though. The Court of Oyer and Terminer, so the witch trials court, it's disbanded in October. It's not long after this incident. And part of that reason is that the governor's wife seems to have been named as a alleged witch. She's never arrested. She's never formally charged or anything. But that accusation would have been shocking. But also, there's just so much public outrage by this time. Prominent ministers, local gentlemen, they're writing to the court. They're saying you have to stop using spectral evidence, bare minimum. Petitions and letters and documents written by the accused and their families are flooding in saying you have to stop. Innocent people are being at minimum accused, but also executed. So it's the public outcry that really halts the proceedings, in my opinion. And that's an important lesson for us, that your voice does matter. And if you see injustice happening, speaking out against it is important. If you see injustice happening, make your voice known, because you never know how that will influence what's going on. My main takeaway from the Salem witch trials broadly is this core message of scapegoating. That's something that our museum really strongly emphasizes. If you've ever visited our museum, you'll know our secondary exhibit, Witches Evolving Perceptions, the last display visitors see, we call our witch hunt wall, and it has a formula for a witch hunt, which is fear plus a trigger equals a scapegoat. And we talk about that in the context of the Salem witch trials. During times of great fear and tension, a trigger can emerge to direct the panic, and then innocent people are scapegoated en masse. So we see that in 1692, but we also see that in many modern day events. Perhaps most famously, when we're talking about the Salem witch trials, is of course the second Red Scare, the McCarthy blacklists. Obviously, Arthur Miller made that comparison when he wrote The Crucible, so that's what's best known to us. If you studied the Salem witch trials in high school, that's probably the context in which you learned about it. But this is behavior that happens time and time again. It is just a very human thing to do when you are afraid and there is no tangible solution to point a finger and say, it's your fault. You're the one who is causing this, and if I get rid of you, things are going to start to get better. Our museum offers three 20th century American examples. We talk about the Red Scare. We also talk about the internment of Japanese Americans after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And we talk about the AIDS epidemic being blamed on the gay community. Those are three examples. You know, the list goes on and on. And that's what I always stress when we're talking about these events, because especially when we're talking about witch trials, people tend to get caught up in the magic and the supernatural and the Puritans. It's also foreign to us. It's so hard to empathize with them. It's so hard to understand what was going on there. And it's really important for us to refocus and say, we actually have a lot of similarities with these individuals. And we react the same way that they did today in our modern world. And that's why we study history. That's the core message of learning about the Salem witch trials.
Just days after the horrific, crushing death of Giles Corey, eight more people who had been convicted of witchcraft by the court would be hanged at Proctor's Ledge. By the fall of 1692, it was clear that months of fear and accusations had caused much of the community to become unhinged. In future episodes, we'll continue to explore what happened between the spring and autumn of 1692 as this epic tragedy continued to unfold. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.